tens of thousands of Iraqi Christians were forced to flee their homes.
Daily reports of attacks against Christian believers here in India.
Christians have long been one of Pakistan's most marginalized communities.
For months, the government has demolished scores of churches and torn down hundreds of crosses.
A Christian has been publicly executed in North Korea.
Dozens of Christians have been arrested in a private prayer meeting in Saudi Arabia.
You're listening to Crest in the Afternoon's coverage of Under Caesar's Sword, a look at the global persecution of Christians and the ongoing quest for universal religious liberty. Many of these interviews were recorded in Rome on December 10th through the 12th.
And a good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. We continue our discussion of our Rome conference, Under Caesar's Sword. And with me right now is Dr. Paul Marshall, associated with the Hudson Institute, author of many books, and I just learned you've been spending a good deal of your time in Indonesia.
Yeah.
Indonesia is the largest Muslim nation in the world, is that right?
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
It's got people about 270 million and 90% Muslim.
And if I'm correct, India also has a second largest Muslim population, is that right?
Yeah, I'm never quite sure. India, Bangladesh, Pakistan,
okay,
they're
that,
close.
That area, but though. But they're all non-Arab.
Big. Right.
They're all non-Arab.
Oh, yeah, so most Muslims live in Asia.
Exactly. Right. And at the same time, in the United States, normally when we talk about Muslim issues regarding religious liberty, we're talking about the Middle East.
Yep.
So it would be valuable to hear how it looks in Indonesia.
Okay, I would say one reason I'm working in Indonesia is because looking at the Middle East, you think, what can you do? Well, there are things we can do, but in terms of the pathology of that area, what happens long term? What's going to stop the war and conflict and repression? And you need to have different versions of Islam. Indonesia, as we mentioned, the world's largest Muslim country. And it has problems. I mean, last month there were two churches burnt down in parts of Indonesia. But the dominant form, the hegemonic form of Islam in Indonesia is peaceable and open and reinterpretive. So one thing I want to see is that Indonesian Islam has more influence in the Muslim world. That's what they want, both at the government level and then big organizations such as Nahdlatul Ulama, 40 to 50 million followers.
Wow.
Muhammadiyah, wow. 30 million, 40 million. They're seeking to do outreach in the Muslim world. And I would like to sort of certainly replace ISIS or something. But with Indian Muslims, we can sit down and argue about religion and talk about our differences and then say, well, we haven't resolved anything. Let's get together next week. I'm actually a visiting professor at the largest state Islamic university in Indonesia.
I was unaware of that.
And it's sort of honorary. I don't have to teach regular courses, but I lecture there. I have that byline. I'm open to that. I gave the commencement address to the graduate school at another state Islamic university in Bandung. So there's this openness to discussion.
Interesting.
Now, there are people who disagree. They worry about demonstrations at the university, people, and so on. Sweetness and light. But these big Muslim organizations are committed to an Islam that is open. The big congress I mentioned with Nahdlatul Ulama, the theme was Islam Nusantara, which means the Islam of the islands. Indonesia's all islands,
yes,
the biggest one in the world. And part of the theme was historical and sociological. It says, the Arabs were in desert, it was dry, it was harsh, You better be tough and harsh if you're going to live there.
Mm-hmm.
It says, we live on islands, we live on ports, we're interacting with people. It says, Islam came here with missionaries and merchants, a lot of them from China. It says, we trade with India. Yeah, we've got Hindus here, we've got other. So we're always been interactive, plural, people have always been living next to each other, and that has shaped our Islam. But they're saying, we don't just mean oh, it happens to be here. If you don't live on islands, it's not going to happen. So, no, that shaped our understanding, but we believe this is an interpretation of Islam.
Yeah.
That it isn't conditioned by a sort of Arab tribal world.
Mm-hmm.
And but this is authentic. So, I mean, the scholarly works, books, there are graduate programs in dealing with Islam Nusantara. So, and talking with leading Muslim scholars there in terms of how they understand Islam, what their understanding of Sharia is. So there's a lot going on. And Indonesia has always felt like the second-class cousin because it came up in the sessions today that we tend to think Muslim world, Arab.
That's right. Yeah, that's
and the attitude amongst many Arabs that, you know, we're the true Muslims.
Right, the Quran's in Arabic.
It's Arabic, it's yep. here. Arabia's here. And that the people outside, this includes Africa, Central Asia, and whatever, are, you know, not quite good Muslims. The
right.
Indonesians are sort of really syncretists.
They're
sort of Hinduism. And the Indonesians have felt insulted about that for a while, and they're saying, no, we're not. we have different views of you. We have scholarships, and we have dozens, probably over 100 Islamic universities. And the Indonesians were the biggest Muslim country. Now we've got the biggest economy. We've just had our 8th successful democratic election. We're largely peaceful. So we think we have things to teach the Arab world. Oh. They don't have very much to teach anybody right now. And so there's that sort of outreach. So I still do work on the Middle East, especially my colleague Nina Shea, very focused there. But I like being able to come back to Washington with good stories,
yes.
with happy
yes.
stories. Tell you what this happened in the meeting. And I gave a lecture a while ago at Baylor University, and with her permission, have a photograph. We can't put it on the web. I don't have that permission. But Muslim lady I met at a Chinese language mosque in Surabaya. She's walking along. Okay. She's wearing a headscarf, jilbab. Not a face covering, but the headscarf. Okay,
yes.
It's the Stars and Stripes.
Yeah.
I said, can I take your picture? I did. So she said, okay, and then take a picture. And she does this. And she wasn't making a political statement. I love America and so on. It was simply colorful. And
yes.
most of them are pink, orange, green, or whatever. So that's a very long answer. But that's what encourages me.
Yeah.
And to see... we just had in the conference here in Rome, Mustafa Akyol, a Muslim man, a friend, saying, you know, the change is got to come through Muslims.
Yeah.
You know, if Westerners say, you got to do this, it's not going to have any effect.
Right, right. It's got to grow within their own tradition.
Yeah, and you've got to be able to persuade people it's rooted in that tradition. It says, you're not just doing that because the Americans did it or
right.
something.
Right, right. No, it's got to come out of it. It's similar to the way, in some ways, that Dignitatis Humanae grew up within in a Catholic rethinking of religious liberty. We're going to continue the conversation with Dr. Paul Marshall on the possibility of change within Islam.